Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Charleston for the UK's only festival devoted to the short story. As some of you will know already from attending previous events, one of the unique peculiarities of Charleston and Small Wonder is that because we are in a barn next door to a dairy farm, at some point during the afternoon, you'll suddenly be aware of a loud humming sound interfering with the microphones. It's caused by the milking machine, so it's no cause for alarm, but I just wanted you to be aware of it. I'm afraid it's the price that we pay to keep the cows happy. As all of you know, the magazine Granta has a long and distinguished history, publishing early works by A.A. Milne, Michael Frayn, Stevie Smith, Ted Hughes, and Sylvia Plath. It was reborn as a publication in 1979, and it's published many of the world's finest writers, tackling some of the world's most important subjects. And what shines through in each edition is a belief in the power and urgency of the story, both in fiction and non-fiction, and the story's supreme ability to describe, illuminate, and make real. So I couldn't be more delighted to be welcoming to chair this event, Granta's publisher, Sigrid Rousing, is at the far end, together with three recent Granta contributors, Rachel Cusk, next to Sigrid, Janice Galloway, on the end here, and then Colin Grant next to Janice. I'm going to introduce Sigrid, and then Sigrid is going to introduce the others. Sigrid is a publisher, a philanthropist, and an anthropologist. She has a doctorate in social anthropology from the University College London, and in 1995 she founded the Sigrid Rousing Trust to support human rights internationally. In 2004 she was the joint winner of the International Service Human Rights Award, and in 2005 she won a Beacon Special Award for philanthropy. Also in 2005, she co-founded Portobello Books, and the same year she bought Granta Publications, of which she now chairs the board. And Sigrid is also, wonderfully for us here at Charleston, a trustee of the Charleston Trust. So I'm going to hand over to Sigrid Rousing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can you all hear me? Good. Well, welcome to Charleston. And to this event, which is entitled Life Stories. I have with me today Janice Galloway at the end, Colin Grant and Rachel Cusk. We will be discussing the art of writing memoir based on their pieces and recent issues of Granta, going back and the F word. Please join me in welcoming them to Charleston. I begin with Janice Galloway. Janice Galloway has written several books, including the novel The Trick is to Keep Reading, the memoir This Is Not About Me, which was selected the Scottish Nonfiction Book of the Year, and the newly published sequel All Made Up, both published by Granta. She's won several awards, including the American Academy of Arts and Literature Ian Foster Award. She's been writer in residence to four Scottish prisons and was a TLS research fellow to the British Library. She's also written extensively for radio. Janice, can you tell us a little bit about what you're going to read?
I hope so. It's kind of strange being in here. It's shortly after 2 o'clock and it's like the middle of the night. I can't actually see the people at the back, which is making me feel rather strange, so I'm isolated here. It's a piece from a book called All Made Up. The first of these two books that are kind of tandem was called This Is Not About Me, because I suppose we better flag it up at the start. I don't think memoir essentially is about the person it purports to be about. It tends to be about what surrounds them. And All Made Up is a kind of chime of the same thing. And it's about what I hope are the general elements that make up teenage years. So we're based in Scotland, but it's not about Scotland. It's through Scotland. It's not about me. It's through me. And this is about my first boyfriend. Will I read? Of course it's... You have no idea how loudly I can speak. Is that better? I can hear an echo now. Is that better? Where's the lady who asked? Better? Okay. Now that we've made that better, perhaps we haven't made this any better. How's that? Yes. Okay. If you can't hear me yell, I do very well with instruction despite appearances. So just yell. Bradley chucked a note on my desk in French. in the middle of irregular verbs. And we were an item for almost a year. He was my first boyfriend and came loaded with unexpected treasures. I thought boyfriends were about holding hands and kissing. The Jackie, a magazine from which I learned how to be a woman, had not prepared me for the best part, which was more to do with being let in on another life. By the end of that year, I could respray a car with cellulose paint, kickstart a motorbike, change a gasket set, get by as an amateur press photographer, and process my own film. On those bases alone, I have no complaints about Bradley. He lived at the other end of the town where I lived, in a bungalow with his sister and his parents, who were still together but gave the impression they'd much rather not be. His dad, Bob, was a school teacher with an interest in what used to be called glamour photography, and I made a point of never being alone in a room with him. I forget what it was his mother did, but whatever it was made her pretty damn cross. The best thing to do was keep out both their way, and where I did that was Bradley's bedroom. He was the first person I ever met who had a bedroom of his own. It was under the eaves of a small bay window that looked out across the carriage-wide sweep of the shore road. Inside was a narrow single bed and stuff. Now, I'm not talking ordinary stuff. I mean loads of stuff, including motorbike components, Miro-shaped tools, stacks of motorcycle monthly, exchange and marked, custom car, practical photography, jars of cellulose paint, enamel paint, Humbrol, and a jar of gunk. Gunk, on closer inspection, was green alien spawn from a sci-fi movie that claimed to clean your hands, though it looked more likely to melt your skin than disinfect it. As long as I knew him, Bradley was building an engine, patching bodywork with filler or levering off a tyre. If he wasn't, he was watching a Clint Eastwood movie or developing rolls of film in his dad's darkroom. Bradley liked doing things. Camshafts, cooling fins, rocker arms, adjustments of tappets were second nature. His visuospatial ability was 3D clear. He understood mixes of chemicals and what F-numbers and light meters added to the creative framing of a scene. Bradley was as masculine as only a boy's boy on the verge of being a man's man could possibly be. And men, to someone raised in a house that had never had one, were as fantastical as real-life dragons. Left in his room while he clonked about with cylinder heads, I fondled his Army and Navy surplus jumpers, absorbing the textures. I poked about inside the pockets of his bell staff and tried on his leather gauntlets. I took off my clothes to try on his shirts and step into his jeans to feel the space in them firsthand. Men's clothes were full of pockets. The zips were at the front where you could reach them. He didn't mind when I painted his fingernails with nail varnish and tolerated my drawing specks and warts on the big-breasted women he regularly pinned on the walls. Whatever keeps a little lady happy. He must have learned that phrase from his dad or Burt Reynolds, but I didn't mind. I was drawn. His home was not mine, so of course I liked it. I loved the otherness of his skin, the pleasure and warmth of his open embrace. Being folded up inside Bradley was worth any amount of little lady rubbish. And of course, there was the lust. Not just ordinary lust, you know, but that compulsive curiosity, the hair trigger responses that 15-year-olds find at their fingertips without even trying. One day he brought a magazine. It was called The Human Body. Engineered to his fingertips, Bradley showed me the drawings, explained a little about pistons and components, then showed me how they all fit, locked, ticked over as one. Then, as he had perhaps planned all along, he offered to show me where I kept mine. Isn't it astonishing what you have and don't know till somebody tells you? I was grateful as sin. That I learned the word virgin only after I wasn't one seems typical. I can't have been the first in any way to regret having lost some notional treasure I'd never known I had in the first place would have been churlish. What I felt was not, would never be, loss. This was learning. And learning, as I knew from school, was always gain.
Thank you very much. The extract that we created from the book in the magazine piece, you'll remember, was about your first period, and then later trying to get a pill from a moody Catholic doctor with your boyfriend, and it's about drinking and it's about sex. And it ends, I was very struck by the ending, it ends, tradition, O tempora, O mores, O Caledonia. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to ask you a very obvious question that... which is, how much do you see yourself as a Scottish writer and a Scottish being? And particularly when you read that piece, I was aware of how you fell into the cadences of a particular way of mm-hmm. of reading, of telling the story that seems to me very, very Scottish. Are you telling us a story of Scotland in the 1960s and 70s, the story of a culture rather than a family, or as well as a family?
That's a whole lot of questions there, Sigrid. Where to start? You tend not to be aware of the thing you are until other people point it out from you. It's your difference from other people for them. It's your sameness for you. You don't focus on the colour of your skin until somebody else makes you do it. You don't focus on your gender necessarily until those around you make you do it. And certainly I don't walk through the world thinking how Scottish I am. That would be bizarre. I think your nationality comes as a given. Your background comes as a given. Your cultural norms come as a given. And it's when you're a teenager, it's interesting that it fits in with a second book. It is access to the homes of other people that make you realise how weird or not your family are. It's access to how other people do things that you begin to think. There is the famous instance, for example, of John Betjeman writing a poem about being called a common little boy. And it never occurred to him that he was common before somebody else's mother called him that. It doesn't occur to me I'm Scottish until someone points it out basically, because I still live there, and it seems to me a perfectly acceptable, my diction and my language is basically standard English. It's inflected by an accent. Whose isn't? It's that basic. It's that simple. I am fascinated by accent. Being down here, there is a particular kind of unbroken women's voice. You know, voice is up here. That I find completely fascinating, that you are not necessarily aware surrounds you until somebody like me comes along and say, well, where we come from, it's a lot gruffer. It's a bit more down here. You can place presuppositions in that, or you can't. I'm seriously under the impression I'm just a person and I'm writing for other people. It's that basic to me. And the way you get to the universal is through the particular. It's the only way to do it. You cannot write in a particular and generalised way, because everyone's idea of generalised and particular is different. Their own place and their own particularity and their own place in the landscape and their norms are different. So if you write out of where you are, you get right into the roots of where you are. Don't give people the branches, give them the roots. If you go right into where you are, they can say, my version of that was this. Your language has a cadence, wherever any of you in the audience are from, as well as mine. Cadence is vastly important. The music of a language is vastly important. I'm certainly acutely aware of it, but I don't simulate it because somehow it's the marker, it's the rubber stamp of where this has come from. It's the marker of saying, I know you have a music. Does this remind you of yours, or is it different? I have to let you evaluate who you are through being who I am. Does that answer the question?
I find your titles very interesting. I know I'm not the first person to ask about that, but I nevertheless will, because I think it is very interesting. This is not about me, all made up. You read your work, including titles like Life as a Man, Imagined Lives. Mm-hmm. What does it mean?
Well, if I could answer that in a sentence, the books and the radio shows would be a sentence long. I think you actually have to... It's playing with metaphor to a certain extent, Sigrid. Of course it is. It's my ideas on writing. I came to writing through Latin grammar. There's a huge piece in this book which is a paean to my Latin teacher, Dr. Nisbet. I was fortunate to be one of the generation who got all these people who were slightly crackers who'd survived the war and who had no compunction about belting you around the ear, chucking chalk in your open mouth if you yawned, about hitting you with lead shot in the corner of their gown, all this kind of thing. They were characters. They were people with issues before issues were particularly a problem. They were called your personality in those days. And because I was surrounded by these people, I never had a fixed idea. They all had such definite ideas, I didn't have to have one. I love definite teachers. I hate the idea that a lot of our education has come to a kind of blanding where the teacher isn't supposed to have a point of view. They're supposed to be a fount of knowledge. You have to explain where your point of view is so the kids can accept or reject that. You have to have something to bounce off. And because they were things to bounce off, I didn't need to have an idea when I first started writing. Therefore, I didn't have a lexicon of forms that I needed to adhere to. I thought I could play. I'd been a musician, and the verb we use for music, bizarrely, your work is called playing. I used to sit down in a practice room and allegedly play. So when I came to writing, it was the same thing. It was playing. And I didn't see why I shouldn't write a poem like it was knitting. The words go to the end of the page and then you start the next line. There was no need to why not? Nobody had ever told me, don't. They'd said, this is what I think. But they'd never said, you can't. And I'm still slightly confused by absolutes in writing. Therefore, to say this is not about me as a memoir is a kind of cheeky, it's a kind of slightly smart-arsed way of saying, I know it's supposed to be about me. Memoir is the only name of a form of writing that has me twice, me and then moi. So this isn't. And it was also partly a game from being continually asked when I was younger, so is this about you? All the time when I wrote something. I need these games to get me through to the end of a book. Just to keep me taking over, I need to keep my main overarching idea. And in my head, what I'm doing is, again, it's all about reaching you. It's about getting to the reader, saying, where do you come in this? Do you think this is about me? How far is this about you? How far is this about someone else? All made up is playing with the idea of the fairy tale. Yeah. At the end of the fairy tale, they all live happily ever after.
Thank you.
Well, they don't when it gets to this.
Thank you, Janice Galloway. I'm going to move on to Colin Grant now. Colin is a producer for the BBC, and he's also worked as a script editor and written and directed several plays, as well as radio drama documentaries. He's a historian and an associate fellow for the Center for Caribbean Studies. He's the author of the biography about Marcus Garvey, the publisher, entrepreneur and founder of the Back to Africa movement in America, entitled Negro with a Hat, The Rise and Fall of Marcus Garvey and His Dream of Mother Africa, and the forthcoming memoir about his father, Bag Eye at a Wheel, set in 1970s Luton, extracted in Grant Are Going Back. Actually, not extracted in Grant Are Going Back. We were talking about this before. I thought it was, but actually the book came out of the Grant Are piece, which was entitled Lino. Colin, will you tell us about what you're reading from?
Thank you, Sigrid. Yes, so I'm going to read a story called Lino, which is set in 1972. And Lina is now a chapter. I do thank Granta for seeing the virtues of Lina, because it convinced the publishers, Jonathan Cape, to allow me to publish a kind of memoir. Equally, it is a kind of memoir, as Janice said. And it's set in Luton, which is a kind of town of a social experiment, I think. And it's set on an estate which has largely been built for the Irish. But there are a few Caribbean families there. And my father, Bagai, and I'll explain his name shortly, my father, Bagai, is a man who is a bit worried about the fact that there are very few Caribbean people on this estate, and for some reason the council decided to put them one next to each other. And he would say, imagine this, I travel 3,000 miles to get away from these people, and who do they put next door? So I'm going to read from Lina. It's quite a nice background hum, isn't it? When I write, I like to have some sort of background noise, and that's not a bad one, actually. I might ask Charleston about it. So 1972, and although it's called Bag Out the Wheel, the memoir, rather like Janice was saying, this is not really about me. It's about the people around me and the times that we live in. I had this rather vain idea that I can not have bifocals, and it sort of shows up when I try to read, but here we go. It was a big news day. We were going to look for a piece of lino for the back room. At least that was the plan. Bagger had woken irritably in the morning to a strong reminder from our mother that he'd been promising this was the day. You start already, said Bagger. Not even have breakfast, and you start already. He rifled through a kitchen drawer, picked up a knife, and began to peel an orange as his wife laid before him the inarguable fact that he couldn't put off buying the lino any longer, especially as the health visitors were coming first thing next week to inspect the house following the arrival of baby G. She finished her piece and waited for him to speak. Bagai concentrated on the orange until the skin was removed, all the skin was removed, and the unbroken kiss curl peel dropped into the bin. She tried again. You never hear? The government people did warn you once. Bagai didn't blink. He took it all in as a news flash that until now had been kept from him. He cut the top off the orange as some people cut the top off a boiled egg. Only when he'd munched his way through the entire orange did I see through the crack in the door that he was heading towards us. Everyone assumed innocent positions on the floor or settee as his head came round the door. His eyes fell on the cracked, degraded lino. He scanned the room for culprits and half muttered to himself and half declaimed, not even 6 months, and then mash up the thing so? We children were careful not to catch his eye, but at the same time trembled at the consequences of being caught looking away. He shouted in our general direction, carry on, you picnic gonna bury me, and it's ball you will ball when them screw down the coffin lid. It was already 9 o'clock, yet the heavy curtains, Bagger noticed, were not fully drawn, contrary to the rules. It could only mean one thing. Something was being hidden. He tugged at the curtains and exposed the crack and pebble-sized hole in the window above the sill that had still not been fixed but plugged with newspaper taped to the glass. A week had passed since that particular catastrophe. Bagger had forgotten about it, but he pulled back now from opening up this new avenue of discontent. His sad bag eyes were cast over his offspring, and he singled me out to keep him company on the journey he was suddenly determined to make. He turned to the others who'd be left behind. And Nabada lang down your mout. Bagai mistook the sour faces of my brothers and sisters for disappointment, when really their expressions were designed to put him off choosing them. I hadn't yet perfected the look. My father favoured me because, as he often declared to the others, even though I was only 10, that boy is a common-sense man. I was told to run a comb through my head and put some shine on my shoes quick time. Bagai, meanwhile, adjusted his paisley scarf. He wore it like an English gentleman and put his brown corduroy cap on, telling anyone who cared to listen, when you don't see me, I gone. You have to admit, the man had style. Outside, Bagay ran the chamois leather over the roof of the car before he got in. Slipping into his favourite spot behind the wheel, he turned to inspect how I intended to close the passenger side door. Okay, it was only a second-hand mini estate. You might not think much of it, but Bagay didn't work all that overtime and those night shifts at the Electrolux factory just so that us picnickers could slam off the door. His scrutiny, though, did pose a slight dilemma, because if you pulled the door too gently, it wouldn't close properly. And why? As far as my father was concerned, if you hadn't managed on the second go, then it's best to pretend that you had. Slide in, close the door firmly, look straight ahead, and whatever you do, do not ask where we're going. Those were the essential points to concentrate on. Let we check by Bernard first, said Bagay. It was what he always said when anything, any appliance or furnishing needed to be replaced. We would head for Bernard's junk shop, the bargain box. There was no way, of course, that we could go straight to Bernard's. Bagay would have to check by a few of his friends first, call in on his spa along the way. I was very well versed in the rules of my father's world and equally conscious that the rules could change at any time. Just a few minutes into the journey, Bagay wanted to know how his son felt about a piece of carpet instead of the lino. Man to man, I'm asking you, he said. Carpet would be nice. I felt my way to what should have been the right answer. But isn't it too expensive? And surely lino or carpet, us kids will match it up the same way. It was a good response. You see your mother? Credit? That woman just loved credit. Never know a woman love credit so. He eased back on the gas, the better to take the subject in his stride. A man must pay him bills before he can allow himself the smallest luxury. It was no surprise then that we seemed to be heading in the direction of Joe Barnes's. While most of my father's friends like him were lean and tidily but modestly built, Joe Barnes had arms that bulged like Popeye's after a can of spinach. He had taken an Atlas course and turned out magnificently. But more than his athleticism, it was his generosity that impressed our mother and us kids. Only Bagay demurred. Bagay was still smarting from heroic Joe's latest unwelcome intervention into our lives, dropping off a free bag of corn on the cob at the house a few nights back when Bagay was on the night shift. The way Bagay saw it, he didn't remember ever asking Joe to bring that stinking sack of corn on the cob to the house in the first place. Though Joe said it was a gift, Bagay shuddered at the shame of his wife letting Joe leave empty-handed. Imagine that. How you feel that made me look, moaned my father. A long-seed man like me can't provide food on the table for him, Pitney. Joe and his women lived up at Hightown, in one of those houses where you went from the street to the front room in one step. Except on this day, there were so many sacks in the front room that we could hardly squeeze in. Each room in the house was full of hemp sacks. The sacks were full of corn on the cob, and the smell announced that they were just beginning to turn. Joe was a wheeler dealer. He was a man who always knew a man who knew a man. Only one man liked to take chances more than Joe, and that was Bagay. And when the time came to leave Joe's, I knew that even though we already had enough corn to last us a month, we'd not be leaving empty-handed. Somehow Bagay seemed to see mother's disbelief and disdain anticipated in my own face. Make us stay there, cuss a bad word, Bagay said of his wife. I know a man, one of my spa, might can do something with this. I foresaw a future of corn on the cob for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And though I never saw the money pass hands, I reckoned there'd be no more discussion about the merits of carpet over lino.
Thank you very much. It's a piece that veers between affection, even admiration for your father, but also the sense of that incipient threat. You know, you get a very clear sense that he was a violent man. Has he? We talked a little bit about this at lunch. Has he spent?
Yes, I was estranged from my father for 30 odd years, and When I was at university, I used to tell people when they asked me about my father that the best thing that one could do would be to cut his head off and put it on a pole as an example of what bad fathers or bad husbands, what would happen to them. So I wasn't very happy with my father in most of my adolescence and adulthood. But with the passage of time, I've come to see that actually even a violent man, which is what he was, could be a candidate for compassion. But there is no pity in this book, and I was very concerned that there should be no pity and very little misery. And I would try to lace the book with humor, because this was a time when actually the parents that I had and the people around them, the Caribbean people around them, to me were like giants, not just giants in their size, but in terms of their personalities. They had these wonderful, quirky personalities, just as maybe Janice's peers and uncles and aunts were personalities. And so when I wrote the memoir, and I've handed it in now to the publishers, they were concerned about privacy laws, and maybe Rachel might talk about this later. So they were rather keen that I show him the book. So they've made a very early proof copy, and I've given it to him, and he greeted it with a very wide smile. He's not a big reader, so I'm hoping he won't read it in detail, but I think he might be pleased by it. But actually, he will recognize some of the wonderful characters in it. So this is a man who came from the Caribbean, from Jamaica. Both my parents are Jamaican, came to England in the early 60s, late 50s, early 60s. And there are many, many characters in this book, and they all had nicknames. My father's nickname was Bag Eye, because he had very baggy eyes. It's subcutaneous edema. But he got the name Bag Eye at an early age. And equally, there are other funny characters like Shine was bald. Tidy Boots was very fastidious. Pumpkin Head had a pumpkin-shaped head. And my all-time favorite was a guy they called Summerware. Now, when Summerware came to this country from Jamaica in the early 60s, he insisted on wearing light summer clothing, no matter the weather, rain or shine. And recently I asked my mother whatever happened to Summerware, and she said, well, within 6 months he caught a cold and died.
I think what I'm getting at, when you write memoir, is the risk that you have to take, it seems to me, is as much that you expose other people than that you expose yourself. You know, you're potentially hurting other people around you, and you have to take, you have to have the courage, but also in a sense the ruthlessness to be able to do that. Was that something you wrestled with?
Yes, I mean, I think all writers are arrogant buggers, and it takes a degree of arrogance to write in the first place and to think that anybody would be interested in reading it. But in Jamaica, we say there are no such thing as facts. There are versions. And this is just a version. My siblings, I have six siblings, will each have their own version. Mm-hmm. And one thing I was adamant that I would do was to not tell the same old miserable stereotypical story. So when I was growing up, the story of the black man in this culture was that of the feckless man who paid no attention to his family, but also would produce children who would do no good. They might be good at robbing and stealing and failing exams. So I was keen not necessarily to write hagiography, but to put a more kind of interesting and nuanced spin on the story of a migrant family like our family. But equally, I've given a copy of this early proof to each member of my family, each sibling. And they haven't, in fact, I think any of them's read it yet. They're a bit nervous about it. But I think they'll be pleased by it. I think they'll see it as a kind of a memorial of a certain kind of quirky time where we felt rather under the spotlight. In fact, one of the phrases that my father used time and again was that you're being watched. Mm-hmm. You're being watched to see which way you turn as a migrant in this country, as a Caribbean boy. You're being watched to see whether you conform to some stereotype. So in the same way that the Italians would say bella figura, he had this notion of bella figura, show your best side all the time. And the way the book is a kind of bella figura in a comic way.
I mean, the book begins very startlingly with you as a child on the street with an Irish woman who is mad and drunk, kind of shouting at you and abusing you, basically telling you, who do you think you are? Because she's maddened by the thought that your mother has the audacity to want to send you to a private school. And I wanted to connect that to something that Janice was saying towards the end when we were talking, you know, that voice, who do you think you are? You know, it seems to me that that was part of your culture, but also in a sense part of what you had to grow up with. You know.
Well, I'm a very, very privileged man. My parents both worked at Vauxhall Motors on the production line, making cars. But my father and my mother were very nervous about the kind of education that the state might offer me. And so, in a way, the book is just 1 year where they are saving up money to send me to private school. I went to a very nice private school called St. Columbus College in St. Albans. And but at that time, in Luton, on that estate, there was a lovely lady called Mrs. Ayres, who I delivered the newspapers for, but she was mad. And she was driven mad by the gulf between the expectation that she had for her life and the reality of it. But she had a treasure. She had a daughter who'd gone off to teacher training college. And so this daughter and Mrs. Ayres, they were the stars of the estate. And I suppose she was worried that I would eclipse her star. So there was that kind of, in Jamaica, we'd say that culture of crabs in a barrel. Mm-hmm. You know, when the crabs are in the barrel and one wants to emerge out of the barrel, the other crabs chop off the arms. Mm-hmm. And so there was that side to life in Luton on that estate as well. Yeah. So that's what I bring in Mrs. Ayres. She plays that role. Bless her.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to go on to Rachel Cusk. Rachel was born in Canada, educated in England. Her debut novel, Saving Agnes, won the Whitbread First Novel Award in 1993, marking the beginning of a stellar literary career. She's written 7 novels, 2 works of nonfiction, and is a regular contributor to The Guardian and The New Statesman. Rachel has been shortlisted for the Orange Prize for Fiction and was named one of Granta's best young British novelists in 2003. Her book, Aftermath, is a searching exploration of womanhood, family life, and divorce. And again, I think, started its life in Granta, the F word. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're going to read?
Well, the fun stops here. So Granta asked me to write an essay about feminism. And so I suppose this, and feminism for me, like writing, is something that it's a set of ideas that somehow I have to make real in life by living them. So that was, I tried to find feminism in my own life, a good way of explaining it as a dilemma for a woman of my generation. And I found that in marriage and wrote an essay about marriage, which I'm going to read. It's quite unlike the others. My memoir writing is very much about me, and it's quite difficult to read it aloud. For me, this kind of writing that I do is really very much about the core of the privacy of the writer-reader relationship. So it feels strange to read it, so you'll have to, if it sounds a little raw, you'll have to bear with me. I'm going to start at the beginning. Recently, my husband and I separated, and over the course of a few weeks, the life that we'd made broke apart, like a jigsaw dismantled into a heap of broken-edged pieces. Sometimes the matrix of a jigsaw is undetectable in the assembled picture. There are champion jigsaw makers who pride themselves on such things, but mostly you can tell. The light falls on the surface indentations. It's only from far away that the image seems complete. My younger daughter likes doing jigsaws. The older one does not. She builds card houses in whose environs everyone must remain silent and still. I see in these activities differing attempts to exert control, but I am struck too by the proof they provide that there is more than one way of being patient and that intolerance can take many forms. My daughters take these variations in temperament a little too seriously. Each resents the opposing tendency in the other. In fact, I would almost say that they pursue their separate activities as a form of argument. An argument is only an emergency of self-definition, after all. And I've wondered from time to time whether it is one of the pitfalls of modern family life, with its relentless jollity, its entirely unfounded optimism, its reliance not on God or economics, but on the principle of love, that it fails to recognize and to take precautions against the human need for war. The new reality was a phrase that kept coming up in those early weeks. People used it to describe my situation, as though it might represent a kind of progress. But it was, in fact, a regression. The gears of life had gone into reverse. All at once, we were moving not forwards, but backwards, back into chaos, into history and prehistory, back to the beginnings of things, and then further back to the time before those things began. A plate falls to the floor. The new reality is that it is broken. I had to get used to the new reality. My two young daughters had to get used to the new reality. But the new reality, as far as I could see, was only something broken. It had been created, and for years it had served its purpose. But in pieces, unless it could be glued back together, it was good for nothing at all. My husband believed that I had treated him monstrously. This belief of his couldn't be shaken. His whole world depended on it. It was his story, and lately I have come to hate stories. If someone were to ask me what disaster this was that had befallen my life, I might ask if they wanted the story or the truth. I might say, by way of explanation, that an important vow of obedience had been broken. I might explain that when I write a novel wrong, eventually it breaks down and stops and won't be written anymore, and I have to go back and look for the flaws in its design. The problem usually lies in the relationship between the story and the truth. The story has to obey the truth, to represent it, like clothes represent the body. The closer the cut, the more pleasing the effect. Unclothed, truth can be vulnerable, ungainly, shocking. Overdressed, it becomes a lie. For me, life's difficulty has generally lain in the attempt to reconcile these two, like the child of divorce tries to reconcile its parents. My own children do that, forcing my husband's hand into mine when we're all together. They're trying to make the story true again, or to make the truth untrue. I'm happy enough to hold his hand, but my husband doesn't like it. It's bad form, and form is important in stories. Everything that was formless in our life together now belongs to me. So it doesn't trouble me, doesn't bother me to hold his hand. After a while, time stopped going backwards. Even so, we had regressed quite a long way. In those few weeks, we had undone everything that led to the moment of our separation. We had undone history itself. There was nothing left to be dismantled, except the children, and that would require the intervention of science. But we were before science. We had gone back to something like 7th century Britain, before the advent of nationhood. England was in those days a country of compartments. I remember at school looking at a map of the early medieval Heptarchy and feeling a kind of consternation at its diffusity, its lack of centralized power, its absence of king and capital city and institution. Instead, there were merely regions whose names, Wessex, Mercia, fell effeminately on the ears, and whose ceaseless squabblings and small laborious losses and gains seemed to lack a driving, unifying force that I might, had I cared to think about it, have identified as masculine. Our history teacher, Mrs. Lewis, was a woman of size and grace, a type of elephant ballerina in whom the principles of bulk and femininity fought a war of escalation. The early medieval was her period. She had studied at Oxford, and now here she was in the classroom of our mediocre Catholic girls' school, encased in a succession of beige tailored outfits with coordinating heels, from which it seemed her mighty pink form might one day startlingly emerge, like a statue from its dust sheets. The other thing we knew about her, from her name, was that she was married. But how these different aspects of Mrs. Lewis connected, we had no idea. She gave great consideration to Offa of Mercia, in whose vision of a unified England the first thrust of male ambition can be detected, and whose massive earthwork, Offa's Dyke, still stands as a reminder that division is also an aspect of unification, that one way of defining what you are is to define what you are not. And indeed, historians have never been able to agree on the question of whether the dyke was built to repel the Welsh or merely to mark the boundary. Mrs. Lewis took an ambivalent attitude to Offa's power. This was the road to civilization, sure enough, but its cost was a loss of diversity, of the quiet kind of flourishing that goes on where things are not being built and goals driven towards. She herself relished the early Saxon world, in which concepts of power had not yet been reconfigured. For in a way, the Dark Ages were themselves a version of the new reality, the broken pieces of the biggest plate of all, the Roman Empire. Some called it darkness, the aftermath of that megalomaniacal, all-conquering unity, but not Mrs. Lewis. She liked it, liked the untenanted wastes, liked the monasteries where creativity was quietly nurtured, liked the mystics and the visionaries, the early religious writings, liked the women who accrued stature in those formless, inchoate centuries, liked the grassroots, the personal level on which issues of justice and belief had now to be resolved in the absence of that great administrator, civilization. The point was that this darkness, call it what you will, this darkness and disorganization were not mere negation, mere absence. They were both aftermath and prelude. The etymology of the word aftermath is second mowing, a second crop of grass that is sown and reaped after the harvest is in. Civilization, order, meaning, belief, these were not sunlit peaks to be reached by a steady climb. They were built and then they fell, were built and fell again, or were destroyed. The darkness, the disorganization that succeeded them, had their own existence, their own integrity, were betrothed to civilization as sleep is betrothed to activity. In the life of compartments lies the possibility of unity, just as unity contains the prospect of atomization. Better, in Mrs. Lewis's view, to live the compartmentalized, disorganized life and feel the dark stirrings of creativity than to dwell in civilized unity, racked by the impulse to destroy.
Thank you very much. Listening to that, again, I've read it many times, but listening to that, I was struck again by how spare it is and the essential aloneness that is in that piece, which, of course, to some degree, is because it's about a separation and divorce. But also the sense, if we think about your piece and your writing, and Collins and Janice's writing, there's a sense in which they're both supported and perhaps enmeshed in a kind of fine net, cultural net. Whereas your writing strikes me as very alone. You know, you come from a culture, obviously, we all come from a culture. But for you, there's a sense that you don't represent anybody, not even women or...
What's the answer? Well, it's not really a question, but I think I wouldn't write anything, but particularly not this kind of thing, unless there was a risk involved. One sec, close to the microphone. For me, it's about risk and about risk as a way of taking a risk as a way of asserting individuality, and individuality to me is the key constituent of my kind of writing. And I mean, the question that I sort of anticipate being asked, so now I'm going to ask it to myself, is, you know, why would you write a memoir? Why would you do this personal thing? Why would you expose yourself in this way? And my answer to that is partly to do with individuality. I think there are, I mean, memoir is a form, like the novel's a form, like a poem is a form, and there are certain experiences in life that lots of people have, like having a baby, like getting divorced, in which, even though they're generic, even though they're universal and every
not everybody, a lot of people experience them, you still feel alone in them. And to me, that is what a memoir is for. It's because that is how it feels to live it. You feel not like other people. Mm-hmm. You feel that it's not a story. Mm-hmm. It's not something... you know, you can see other people have done it, but you didn't know how it felt just from watching them do it. And to me, the form is very, very well suited. I mean, the other memoir I've written is about having a child. So I think you see me in this moment of aloneness in this kind of writing. I mean, I think is where the feeling comes from. But I think it is how people feel when their marriages break up, when they have a baby. I think that these, in fact, are experiences of isolation.
I mean, I think the book you wrote about motherhood, was a really searingly honest account of what you felt being a mother, and perhaps made you more controversial than you had anticipated. Can you talk about the cost of that? You know,
better than being a cow on that milking machine. The cow got away from the milking machine and wrote a memoir.
Yes.
What was the cost? I couldn't possibly evaluate it. Just thinking about trying to express... what it's like to individually to experience certain things in a very solitary way, and as an individual, where it's really your own individual experience is the only experience available. Motherhood, as I said, being a good example of that. Part of what my writing in these areas is for is to say I don't agree with the image. You know, there's an image of what this is like, and I've lived it, and it's not like that. And you know, I don't know whether this writing about marital breakdown will have anything like the same dissonance, really, between image, because there is no great image of divorce. I mean, nobody thinks that that's a, you know, marvellous experience, whereas people, you know, do say that of motherhood. So I think the disagreement with my motherhood book very much came from that. It was that thing that I had objected to was coming back and sort of bashing me on the head. So in terms of a cost, maybe there was one, but I should have factored it in, and I do now.
I think, this is really a question for all of you before we open it up to the audience for questions. It occurs to me that it is... It would be very hard now to write, a thoroughly happy memoir, you know, to write like Nabokov did about his family. He wrote so happily about his family because we live inevitably in a post-Freudian age. And I think on the literary end of that's certainly true, but I think also in the misery memoir world, you know, it is easier to write, to find those memories that are not happy than to find the happier memories. Did you agree with that? Or?
Everyone's looking at me.
You haven't said anything.
That was quite scary. As Rachel says, I mean, I have a dramatic differences from the place she describes as where she's coming from and what motivates her writing, but I have dramatic similarities as well. And one of the similarities is what you write about is, again, it is to reach other people. What other function does it have? If you're writing to sort out your own problems, keep it under the bed. You know, who cares, really? If you're offering it out to other people, you're presumably wishing to offer them something. And what you're wishing to offer them is this anything you recognise? I always think of writing as waving. And what you'd really like to see is somebody, just one hand, waving back, preferably with a cheque. But all they have to do is wave back and you feel you've fulfilled at least something. It's so seldom we get to feel that we have fulfilled anything for any lasting period of time. And I guess it's through that aloneness. That aloneness is part of why you feel that aloneness, is because of the culture you've come from telling you that either alone is the only way to do this, or you seem to be quite reacting against the feeling of having been meant to join in with other people, that somehow we share something. Well, of course we share things, but we share them tangentially, we share them fleetingly, we share them in seconds and moments, and we tend only to admit it when we are alone in bed with a book. By and large, we're quite wary of, as you say, exposing ourselves in person. That isn't in person. This is the great beauty of the book. It's not in person. You're giving yourself, wrapped in several nighties, to other people to take to their bed and have their private experience with. You will never know what that is. And I guess it's part of that aloneness that you are in fact sharing, because everyone, at some time, most people most of the time, feel very alone. So that is a form of sharing. That uniqueness that you're talking about is a form of sharing.
I find happiness more difficult to write about, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And there is this urge to conform and to accept that you are happy. I think a lot of the time in my life I've been miserable and not wanted to share my misery with anybody. I wouldn't necessarily write about it. But I think that there is possibly greater opportunity for nuance in unhappiness. My father, Bagai, I think was a profoundly unhappy man when he was in the house, but he was profoundly happy when he with his mates. And I was very interested in negotiating those two states. But the thing I loved about my father was his walk. I was saying this to my siblings just yesterday, and he had this amazing walk. He walked, I say, like a footballer on the losing side in the FA Cup, walking up the rostrum to collect his loser's medal. So there was dignity in defeat. And I think I've imbued that sense of a kind of horror of success. I used to play basketball. My school was an American school run by American monks. And whenever we were successful, it was a real disappointment to me, actually, because I couldn't escape the sadness of the opposition who had lost. And as Ross Bear said, who shall be happy if not everybody?
And I'm going to take some questions now from the audience. I can't see very well. This is a kind of black sea, so you have to wave. Yes, over there. There's a microphone coming. No.
Are any of you journal keepers? And have you kept journals, any or all of you, all your lives, which you have used in your writing?
I've always regarded it as a failure that I can't keep a diary, and I used to think that was, I mean, just like when I was a teenager and to have a particular, you know, to wear particular clothes, to have particular records, you know, it was part of being, you know, what I wanted to be, whatever that was at the time. And being a writer, my sort of early idea of that, particularly a woman writer, was that you would keep a diary. And in fact, that for me has been like giving up smoking and lots of other things I've always meant to do and have failed to do. And so I sort of wonder, I've read, there's such differences between Sylvia Plath's diary, for example, and Virginia Woolf's. And one is the diary of a socially successful person who can make an entertainment out of her life. And Sylvia Plath, actually, I think, labored under some of the same feeling of that she wasn't a real writer unless she could do this diary. Catherine Mansfield's another one, as I've felt. And their diaries are very fragmentary and almost incoherent, and certainly not a place you can live like Virginia Woolf's diary. I mean, you can completely lose yourself in her social life and her... I mean, I don't quite know how she was able to do that, but I think it's a particular thing rather than a general writerly thing.
I don't keep a diary, and in a way I'm glad I never did, because I found when I came to write this particular book, this memoir, that actually when you write things down, they become very, very concrete and therefore difficult then to break apart. And for the memoir that I've written, I've tried to remember as much as I can, and I've really just evoke the period, and I've focused mostly on the language, but there are things which I've sort of sketched in which may not have been actually true. But when I write them down and now I read back that book, I'm having difficulty separating what I fictionalize, as it were, from the reality. So I think it's quite dangerous to keep a diary or a journal in that regard.
Someone might find it. Someone might find it was exactly going to be my answer. The kind of house I came from, you would have been mad to write down what you really thought about anything. For us, they'd just been crazy. I was a teenager during the period of. Do you remember the awful 5-year diary with Locke on it that people thought was a brilliant idea to give to a girl? Mine was full of drawings. It was full of notes. It was full of things I'd heard on the TV, and occasionally wash hair. That sort of thing was all I was capable of writing down, because you had to be very careful what you wrote down. You never know who's going to read it. These days, I still don't know who's going to read it, but they're paying money, so they're not going to hurt me. They're quite far away. And this is an enormous saving grace. I wrote a book about the wife of Robert Schumann, Clara Schumann, and they kept something called a marriage diary. Dear God, can you imagine? Writing down every day how your marriage is going for the other one to read. They just strike me as crazy, most diaries. If they keep you personally sane, fine, they would have landed me in a lot of trouble, so I never kept one.
Any other questions? Yes.
Hello. I just want to know why memoir, rather than these incredible stories and happenings in your lives, as writers who have also written fiction, I think all of you, is that right? Have you not thought about, did you not think, oh, perhaps I could use that for a novel or something, and then avoid the possible difficulties of truth, hurt, and those issues that memoir bring up?
Well, here's a confession for you. 7 years ago, I went to see an agent with a story called Bag Eye at the Wheel. And it was a fictionalized story of my childhood. And the agent looked at it and rather scornfully said, oh, I can't sell that. No one would be interested in that. Who are you anyway? And now have the same agent, and he doesn't recognize that conversation that we had 7 years ago. But actually, the truth is that I think by not trying to fictionalize it, I've made this particular book anyway richer, because I don't need to give the characters any more color, any more depth, because they're so colorful themselves.
Yeah, I guess it's a similar answer. Enjoying the idea of breaking down what fiction thinks it's doing. I'm never sure what fiction thinks it's doing. I think it has something to do with our education system, that there is such a thing as pure imagination, and that somehow this is much more valuable than just stuff that's happened to you, because goodness me, you would get lots of women writing if they were just allowed to write down things that happened to you. I think there was a vast gender divide about it, because it was assumed that an intellect, a trained mind, as it were, would somehow write down great universal truths out of nowhere. They would write down what happened on other planets. They would write scientific truths, that they would aim for something called a generalized truth. It's Plato's fault. And that women somehow would write romantic stories which were based in either their own fantasies or their own lives. Even at the birth of the novel, most of these women are being dismissed as writers of fantasy, which for some reason is a lesser form than pure imagination. I cannot imagine a better form of pure imagination than fantasy. Basically, I don't believe it. Everything has to come from someplace. It comes from what's around you. It comes from the territory you stand on. It comes from how people have spoken to you, the people you've spoken to, sheer accident. Everything comes through your eyes and ears and down your arm and into the pen, or these days into the keyboard. There is no such thing as something that is all made up. And therefore, I'm starting not to see the difference. As long as it's constructed, life doesn't happen in paragraphs. As long as it's constructed, it's a piece of some kind of art. And I wanted it to be called a true novel, and Grant wouldn't let me. that.
Well, on that note, I think we're 50. I think that we're 15 minutes over the time, so I think we'll wrap up now. Thank you very much, all of you, for, you know, a great panel. Thank you.
I just wanted to echo Sigrid's thanks to all three authors for great and memorable readings, and also to thank Sigrid for getting each of them to talk so openly and honestly about their work and their lives. And all authors are going to be signing copies of their books at the back in a moment. If you could just let us get through the audience and sit at the back before you leave your seats, we'd be very grateful. But please join me again in thanking Rachel Cusk, Janice Galloway, Colin Grant, and Sigrid Rising. Thank you very much.